Hello, welcome to Literally from the North Shore. We're glad you are tuned in. We continue today with Connie Ellis's reading of Shelter Half by Minnesota author Carol Bly, a novel about a handful of people in a northern Minnesota town. We pick up now where Connie left off last time.
Chapter 10 continues. The vehicle Stan wanted him to deliver still had the new car smell of vinyl and metal cleaning agents. For all the thousands of times George had climbed into new cars, he still noted and loved the smell. Garris Auto policy was to leave in the paper foot protection for its delivery so that no workman's boots would muddy the floor fabric. George wouldn't take those away until they got the car into the customer's own driveway. He thought about the nice drop cloth he kept so that Mercine could rest her yarn and knitting project on the floor without getting it dirty. He went to transfer it from his car to the Impala. He stopped. "She wants it. She can just ask," he said to himself. The shock of their quarrel was gradually wearing off. He felt himself no longer freshly wounded. He thought up vengeful things to say. He drove from the lot to his home to pick up Mercine. He opened the house door and shouted, "You ready?" There he was, ready to pick her up in the new sale. Then he clasped his mouth shut. Another woman stood next to his wife, coat in hand. It was Pearl, the ecumenical chorus accompanist and casino gambler. Pearl also managed the VFW lounge. In all three of her occupations, what Pearl was known for was an uncertain temper. Mercine said in a sparkling, purely hostile tone, "Pearl wanted to go along for the ride." She sailed past George, carrying her bag, which he felt gloomily was heavy with that jossable. She was dressed up, he saw, but not for him, dressed up against him, if anything. Mercine wasn't wearing her usual slacks and home knits. She wore her deep rose woolen suit and under it a wide neck, deeper rose blouse of silk. He knew that she had put on that silk with all its chic, the way an officer would decide on full decorations. She went around to the passenger side and sat down with great delicacy. He couldn't help telling her she looked pretty. She was stunning. He said, "You look pretty." She gave him a sniff. They took off. George could see in the rearview mirror that Pearl, in the back seat, was gazing balefully out at the wintry day. Mercine had moxie. What inspired her to pick up that Pearl for this trip? Just meanness is what. He had heard that if you got hold of Pearl at the right moment, she could tell more gossip than anyone else from the Iron Range down to the Twin Cities. She was what church committees called a supply organist. You called her up when your regular organist had failed you. Pearl knew more filth than anyone else about everybody, no matter which church they went to or didn't go to, and her guesses about the real meanings that might lie behind local happenings were very engaging. She was unstinting with her speculations, too. Pearl never said, "Go figure," or "How would I know?" Or "You have to kind of wonder, don't you?" She never, ever wondered about anything. For example, Pearl hadn't minded saying that the dead kid the police had found along Highway 53 last week had probably been killed by someone from that big-shot think tank in the woods north of town. People at the VFW had immediately snorted. Now why would those smart people do something like that? Pearl had sneered right back. "If I knew why big shots and think tanks do what they do, I would lick every house and every casino at blackjack." Pearl had been the first person in town to know that the deputy cop was terrified someone might hit him in his face. Now how would she know that? The guys laughed as they asked because it was satisfying to think of a cop being chicken, so chicken a woman wouldn't notice. That cop had tried out for a state trooper, didn't make it, worked security for a while at a casino. While he had that job, Pearl had seen him. "Who, him?" she was supposed to have said, getting out cold beers for people at the VFW. "Not much there," she then remarked. She passed bowls of chips and nuts across the counter. "Nope," she'd said thoughtfully. "Not much there." Not much of what was the question. Brains, perhaps she meant, or perhaps she meant not much manhood. No vital signs, perhaps she meant. Whatever she meant, it came across from her own authoritative repertoire of loathsome humanity. Pearl was like seawater pollution of a given specific gravity. She swayed suspended at that given level under the surface of St. Firsi society. She recognized the other creatures moving around lethargically at her level. She had an eye for creatures of like density. She herself wasn't going anywhere. She could spot other people who weren't going anywhere. Between the occasional witticism at someone's expense, and once or twice striking a cop, once assaulting a casino goer even, Pearl seemed to live partly in a trance. A low-level, sour-mindedness clung to her, began to permeate the mood in the new car. "Well, okay, Pearl," George thought as he took an occasional glance at her in the rearview mirror. "All I ask is, don't do anything to mess up the back seat of this new vehicle. I don't own it." Once George got them established going north on 53, Mercene took out her knitting and appeared engrossed in solving some problem with it. She had the directions and the yard spread out on top of the safety balloon panel on her side of the dash. She spoke to the knitting pattern in a low, bored voice, like a test pilot repeating specs to a tape. "Knit one, purl two together, all right," she ground out. "Okay, if you say so, if you say so. Ask me, though, this is going to be lumpy. Okay, let's run this past us again. Knit one, two, one together." "For the first 12 stitches," she repeated. George gave up on any possibility of talk. The car ran beautifully under a beautiful sky. The sky's faint light was more like the gleam of a stone than air. George grew bored. Maybe he could rouse Pearl to say some unpleasant thing. "Hey, Pearl," he said into the rear view, "how do you like that sky? Think it means snow?" She said, "Nah, just your typical weather for this time of year." Then Pearl leaned forward between their seats. "Your gas tank's awfully low, George." Idiot of an upset husband that he was, George had not remembered to check it. The dash was flashing amber. "I'll stop in Etheridge," she said. Pulled in alongside a three-pump island, he thought he recalled the owner of, a young fellow who had bought an old Jetta that Stan had taken in trade. The man wasn't there, however. Through the station window, George saw only a woman covering the register and a customer investigating the cold drinks cabinet, probably the one who owned the Buick on the other side of the fuel island. In the office back doorway to the garage, George made out some mechanic's feet jerking on the dolly under their lift. He replaced the pump handle and went in to pay. "I'm on four," he told the woman leisurely. Over her head he read the Minnesota Lottery figures and the Powerball, $131 million today. But the woman's head jerked up from the till and she shouted, "Hey, hey, hey!" George spun around to see what she was shouting about. Garasato's brand new Chevy Impala was tearing out fast, past the pumps, tires screeching. At least the fuel pump handle wasn't dragging. George lit out the station server right behind him. When he got out into the middle of the second lane where he had fueled up, he caught sight of his car stopped about 100 feet away, engine running. He ran over. Pearl was sitting in the driver's seat. She dropped the window. "Just get in, George, and move it," she snapped. Mercene was now in the back. George went around and got into the passenger's side. Pearl clumped her elbow on the all-door lock and glanced in the rear-view mirror. "Uh-oh," she said mildly. A man was closing on them. He lurched right up to the driver's side and pounded both hands on the glass. "Oh, no, not on his new Chevy," George howled and started to get out his side. "Stay put," Pearl told him. She lowered her window and said to the man in a lyrical tone, "Would it be okay if I explain to you what I am doing? I mean, before you wreck my new car and smash my face. Would that be okay? This is my first time ever to drive a good new car. I have saved up for this car for 4.5 years, and today I bought it. I run out of gas on my first trip because the company is too chintzy to give me a tank full. I get it filled, so the shifting is new to me. So I make a mistake and go forward when I was trying to just check out that it was in park. So I finally get it going. This is the first time in my life I have ever owned any new vehicle. And I have got this right, some totally strange clown. You tell me if I have this right. Some totally strange clown like you comes along and, although I like your suit," she interrupted herself, I like that kind of nubby rough tie very much. I always think that heavy texture is much better than the shiny stuff. You come along and go crazy trying to break my window on a new car? Please, mister, this is so mean. What I don't understand is, why would you want to be mean like that? So mean. The fellow's features contorted. Ma'am, he said, I am so sorry. It's just that someone just stole my new hunting dog. And when you took off like that, I guess, I just thought it was you. Pearl narrowed her eyes. She spoke very slowly. I would put a filthy, flea-infested dog in my new car? That is some kind of joke. I'm sorry, he said. Still, his eyes were wandering over to George in the front seat and then to what he must have taken for a chilled old lady bundled up under a dark green afghan in the back. I'm sorry, he said, and he backed up, but still shaking his head. Pearl flashed him a blazing smile. Okay to go now, officer? Oh, golly, said he, raised a weak hand. Infinitely gently, Pearl lowered the lever to drive four, and the Chevy moved out to the furthest end of the service station lot. They had to wait for traffic to get by. Pearl told the others, We'll circle around and then come back, and George, you can pay the bill. You got a cell phone, George? Call that station if you know the number, and tell them you're returning to pay the bill. But we'd really appreciate it if they would get that crazy sex molester off the lot before we stop and open a car door. Mercine had taken on new life. She swung her head 180 degrees left, then right, looked out all the windows like someone riding shotgun. Pearl said, When you were in there, you see anybody you know, George? The guy I know who owns that place wasn't there. Well, then, she said, this is your twice lucky day. She got onto the highway, made two turns onto a back road, made another turn, which took them into the service fueling area again. The woman cashier and this distraught-looking mechanic were now both standing out in front. Mercine said from the back seat, You'd better go on and do the bill paying, George. If I were you, I would tell them that was the last time you were going to get a car with a crazy new car owner, period. George didn't know what Pearl and Mercine were up to, but whatever it was the end of over 3 days of silent temper from Mercine. For a split second, he even wondered, was it possible that women got as bored with ordinary life as men do? So they, too, are glad when just any damn thing happens? He felt springy all of a sudden, really springy. George stepped out of the car. I've come to pay the pump, he said to the attendant and the mechanic. George decided he would pay cash, all things considered. He brought out his best sheepish tone with a fool's grin and said, Look, guys, do me a favor, will you? Don't even ask what happened. What the attendant and mechanic saw was a handsome gray-headed man who had kept himself as trim as a gentleman. In a very high-end, very new car, he had one middle-aged woman and one older middle-aged woman, both of them smiling pretty strangely, probably mental, the both of them. The wife? The mechanic asked sympathetically. Back out in the Impala, no one said anything. As soon as they got clear and northbound out of Etheridge, Pearl made a left turn onto a county highway 44. No, George said, we stay right on 53 the whole way. Pearl said, we stop here on this road because I am going to catch my breath. And while I catch my breath, your wife can tell you what happened. Then we will trade places. Only I will sit in front. Mercine can stay back here, catch fleas and what all else crap from that animal. George turned around. Mersenne pushed away the chasuble and said, Okay, Silver, you don't have to stay anymore. Stan Garris's stolen Labrador immediately leapt forward. She picked her way over the gear panel to kiss George, the second favorite person of her life. She planted her bottom and her powerful back haunches in his lap. They told him how it had gone. They had caught sight of Silver in the car at that next fueling lane. The owner seemed to be gazing at the Powerball and Minnesota Gopher 5 strips in the station office. They decided to make things simple. They just opened the back door of his car and the back door of the Impala and told Silver to come. In the Impala, Pearl told Mercine, I don't like dogs. You get in back with her and I'll drive us out of here. She ran to the front. Mercine told Silver to stay, kept petting her. She made Pearl pass her back the knitting. She grabbed the chasuble. One of the dangling in the round type needles dropped 140 stitches off the left side. Mersenne pulled the needle completely out of the wool, covered Silver and most of herself with it. Meantime, Pearl had gunned the engine and raced off to the point where George had spotted them. Now George said, "Honey, you covered up Silver with that, what's it for the priest?" Everyone laughed. Pearl said, "You let that dog kiss you all over your face like that, George? You're going to have so many diseases come they won't bury you alongside other people." Pearl got out of the car. George made Silver get into the back with Mersenne. As he adjusted the rearview mirror and Pearl did up her seatbelt, he heard Mersenne say, "Oh, no, you don't, Silver. You don't drool on that new customer's car seat. Here, if you have to drool, you drool on that chasuble." All the rest of the way to the Montana Cafe, the three of them traded opinions on what Stan Garris would do and what he would say when he came breezing into that restaurant and saw his friends and the dog waiting for him. Chapter 11. Eliza, the rector of St. Percy Church, was like anyone about to be fired. She felt fired already. Behind the church's altar, she emptied both the inhumane mouse trap and the humane one with its rope. To empty the inhumane one, you grab the little beast by its tail, pry up the strangle bar, and drop the mouse out. Easy enough. Arlene, who cleaned the church, or even the catty flower women, would have been perfectly willing to empty both traps, just as they usually did. But Eliza now wanted the job herself. The garroted mouse she took into hands. She noticed its exquisite ears and astoundingly silky coat. She laid it on the entrance table tracks while she put her coat on. As for the live or so-called humane trap, she raised its tiny portcullis just outside the church door so its victims went free into the crunching frozen hosta. This, instead of carrying both trap and its prisoners to St. Percy Creek, lowering them to soak for a quarter hour at the bottom, it was Saturday morning of what might well be her last week on the job. The bishop would not show up until 11. Against church policy, Eliza had agreed to see a young server beforehand. Adults knew enough to leave the rector alone on Saturdays. Katie's wanting to come meant that Eliza was still of some use to someone. What's more, today being Arlene's half-day cleaning at St. Percy's, Eliza meant to have just one more try at getting the poor woman to make a charge against her husband for battering. Bradstrop was a universal type of no-good male. He beat his wife. He got fired from nearly every job at the bottom of the town's scattershot places of work. He shot wildlife out of season and without a permit. He had recently killed a Minnesota black bear cub. He battered Arlene every 3 or 4 months. Eliza mooned around outside between the church and Lynchgate and rectory, waiting for Katie, waiting for Arlene, dreading the bishop's visit. Eliza and her seminary pals, especially Bill Place, her boyfriend of 3 years ago, had walked leisurely around, grinning over the ironies at this charming little St. Percy Episcopal church in its doomed Northwood setting. Especially its heartbreaking poor box, so old that its wooden top was soft as fur. There were only 3 such poor boxes in the Diocese of Minnesota. Their gapy slots were made for sovereigns, not dollar bills, Bill had said, clearly not intended for chewing gum wrappers. A little of the snow promised for today now came wavering down. It was only 6 days, not years and years, since she had sent the 1,000 times ill-advised email letter to the bishop. In one swoop, she ended her career as an Episcopal priest, a loser thing to do. She was not used to being a loser. Eliza had never been one of the Twin Cities hangabout loser priests. Younger than most of them, she was only 27 even now. Her vanity had never been flattered like the vanity of ordained people whom the bishop wouldn't give a church to. Diocesan secretaries never treated Eliza the way they treated those casuals who agreed to be part-time chaplains for sheltered shops. She had never been gently, tolerantly kidded by leaders who bounded about diocesan meeting rooms and offices on one or another energetic task of the lay ministry. Once through Seabury Western, Eliza had been immediately installed as rector of St. Percy's Church. St. Fursey, Minnesota. She supposed that the bishop had seen something in her. Well, she had seen something in herself, too. Like any 21st century seminarian, she was partly cynical. Well, this was modern America. Anyone with any grasp of reality had to be cynical. Earnestness was so last year. Perhaps the bishop no longer cared whether or not his clergy were cynical. Bill Place was cynical, and he had won the plum at Twin Cities Parish. Reality check, then. Eliza's college and seminary grades had been high. She herself was beautiful, or at least she was not one of the ever-present, stocky-bodied, good-willed female clerics tramping around the diocese. She loved nature, especially northern Minnesota forest land, and always had. She didn't crave a Twin Cities parish like most of her classmates. She had said as much in her career statement. The bishop gave her St. Fursey. St. Fursey, as they called it in the trade, identifying each church by its patron and its location. All that until 6 days ago. Now her young server arrived on a bike despite the weather. A half hour early. Good. Eliza would lightly take care of whatever was bothering Katie, still have a quarter hour to talk to Arlene, the sexton, about her options as a battered wife. Katie locked her bike to the metal sign that read, "Rector Only. Don't even think of parking here." Katie was one terrific little kid, and whatever she had to say would be as good as it gets from a 14-year-old. "Come on, let's go in my study," Eliza said. She took her office chair and waved to Katie to sit beside the desk rather than opposite. The girl remained standing. "Right. Classic old body speak, for I have a problem which I will lay before you, my rector, but chances are you are too chicken to solve it, so I therefore disrespect you. I would take this problem to a psychotherapist or a lawyer, but they cost money, and you are free. I will therefore remain standing." Eliza read the body language and gave a smile. Katie said, "Two things, Eliza. First, there is a slob around town. You probably don't know because he doesn't go to our church. If they let him in anywhere, his name is Brad Strapp." Eliza did know about him, though. He was the wife-battering husband of her St. Fursey's church cleaning woman. Katie said, "We have had a mother bear and two cubs wandering around the edges of town for the last 2 weeks. This time of year is when bears feed up so they can sleep out the winter on their own fat. Well, this slob Brad Strapp shot one of the cubs last week, and he bragged to someone in the VFW he was going to shoot the other cub. Nobody got in his way. You're the priest, Eliza. Will you please do something about this?" Eliza said, "I am hearing you, Katie. Let's hold that one a minute. What is your second thing?" Katie said, "Marty Hanks has been rubbing boogers off on the underside of the communion rail. Does he get to do that just because he is one of your servers? Eliza, it is so repulsive." Katie got that much right. Eliza said, "About Brad Strapp, Katie, I will talk to the senior warden and see what we can come up with." "I already talked to him," Katie said. "Mr. Tenebrae said if he asked the chief of police to trail people like Brad Strapp to keep them from killing wildlife out of season, they would never have time to stop any other crime." Eliza said, "I'll remind him again, and about Marty Hanks and the communion rail. I will talk to him." But she felt like the chief of police. If she tried to track young Marty Hanks, keep him from only one or two of the offenses he seemed to commit in a day, she wouldn't have time for any of her other work. "Look, Katie," she said, "I'm on it, okay? Come on, I'll walk you out." Katie said, "I was pretty sure there wouldn't be anything you could do about it." Eliza was cool. "For now, let me just say I'm on it." She stood up and followed Katie out to the bike stand. Eliza said, "It's Saturday, isn't it, Katie? Are you still building on your treehouse?" Eliza watched while Katie punched a combination lock. "Do you have to lock the bike even here in St. Fursey?" she asked. "Especially here in St. Fursey. Town's full of crooks. Listen, Eliza, you're a priest. You know people suck." "Still, Katie," Eliza said, as the girl raised a foot to the pedal, "people everywhere are basically good. That's something not to forget, not ever." "Sounds good, Eliza, and everyone says it. But what if it just isn't true? What if it's just one more lie? Then the girl switched back to being a well-behaved Episcopalian. Thanks for seeing me, Eliza, she said. Eliza fled into the rectory to change. She braced herself to talk to Arlene. Arlene spoke to her as little as possible. Eliza couldn't hide it from herself that the church cleaning lady was a counseling failure of hers. She heard the nearly animal scratching at her door. Eliza said, Arlene, you have a right to knock a regular out loud knock like everyone else. Come in, come in, come in. I thought you might be busy, she said. If Eliza were busy, she would have to answer to animal scratchings just as much as answer to an ordinary human knock. Aloud, Eliza said, I'm glad you came. Come on in. Arlene left her bucket with its chemicals and rubber gloves and cloths in the hallway. It's about my husband, she said. The bruise that had bloomed roseate on her left cheek last week now showed only faint yellow, but this morning there was something covered with Band-Aid on the opposite jaw. Eliza thought, what a stroke of luck. Here's my last chance to get that woman to request a restraining order. I don't know what you can do exactly, said Arlene. Eliza said over again, you haven't told me. Do what exactly? Exactly what is going on with Brad? It's about that mother bear, Arlene said. My husband is still sneaking around, trying to kill her and that other cub she still has. He already shot one. Damn it all. Arlene wasn't seeking help for her battering. Eliza said, I have already gotten a complaint about that, and I'm going to do something. I will have a word with the police for starters. Arlene retied her apron sash, that summer print apron for cleaning in the choir room alongside Eliza's and the server's vestments. Eliza was proud about it. Her first-class asshole of a parishioner, the father of her first-class asshole of a server, Marty Hanks, had wanted, of all things, that it should be reflected in the vestry minutes, that no sexton's apron should be hooked up there right next to spiritual vestments like Eliza's chasuble and the server's cassocks and everyone's surplices. People who wanted things reflected in the minutes. Oh, yes, it should, though, Eliza had said. That's where it's staying, too. Arlene said no. I already talked to the chief of police, and he probably isn't going to do anything, Eliza. Flat out, he said that. Eliza said, he would actually have to catch Brad in the act, gun and all. I knew it wouldn't do any good to ask you, Arlene said. She went to the door.
You've been listening to episode 13 of Shelter Half by Minnesota author Carol Bly. This book will run for 20 episodes through July 23rd. If you miss a day, remember that all the week's episodes are posted on our website, ktwh.org, on the Literally from the North Shore page, on the program's drop-down menu at the top of the homepage. Be sure to tune in again for the next episode of Shelter Half. The piano music filling out these Shelter Half episodes is performed by Robert Ellis, our reader Connie Ellis's husband, from his CD, Moonrise.